And this is KPCW. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's 8:06 on this Thursday morning, October 23rd. We've got some clouds out there and 38 degrees, 40 degrees under some cloudy skies in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Thursday, KPCW listeners. It's time for a look at your Thursday forecast for the Wasatch Back. We're looking at a mixture of clouds and sunshine as we go throughout today. Temperatures will climb into the mid-50s for highs in Park City. We'll see those highs climbing into the low 60s in the Heber Valley. As we go throughout the day, there is a very slim chance, and we're talking less than 20% chance of an isolated shower sneaking up near the I-80 corridor. But most of the rain chances today will stay well to our south, closer to the I-70 corridor this afternoon. As we go into your forecast, though, for your Friday, we've got the beautiful weather returning as high pressure rebuilds across the area. Temperatures will flirt with the freezing mark for your Friday morning. We'll see those highs climbing into the upper 50s to near 60 in Park City by Friday afternoon. And we'll have those high temperatures climbing into the mid-60s for us in the Heber Valley. As we move into your Saturday, we'll start off with partly cloudy skies, temperatures in the 30s Saturday morning. High temperatures will climb into the low 60s in Park City. We'll see highs in the upper 60s in the Heber Valley. That'll be thanks to a gusty south wind that will start to kick in. And that south wind will be ahead of our next cold front that will be moving in as we go into your Saturday night. Speaking of which, Saturday night, we'll see those rain chances beginning to ramp up as temperatures dip down into the upper 30s Saturday night. As we go throughout the day on your Sunday, you're going to notice a big difference as that next cold front moves through. That's going to send in some gusty northwesterly winds, dropping temperatures, and snow will be likely as we go throughout the day on your Sunday afternoon in Park City going into Sunday night with some accumulations possible. We'll be looking at those rain showers, possibly mixed with a few snowflakes, even down into the Heber Valley by Sunday afternoon into Sunday night. Monday, we start off with temperatures below freezing, so any precipitation left over will likely be in the form of a few snow showers, but otherwise we dry out throughout the day with highs climbing into the mid-40s on Monday in Park City, and we'll see those highs climbing into the low 50s in the Heber Valley, and we stay with cool temperatures into next week. That's a good July's forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. I'll be checking in with Summit County Council Member Roger Armstrong. We'll be taking a look at the agenda from yesterday's meeting. The Executive Director of Summit Community Gardens and Eats, Helen Nadel, with the final garden report of the season. And Live Like Sam Executive Director Ron Jackenthal, along with the founder of We Be Well, Alex Beecraft, have details on a resilience evening for parents next week. Take a look now at some local news. A local writer and filmmaker have teamed up to create a guidebook and short film documenting the rich history of Park City's trail system and the people who made it possible. A few years ago, longtime resident Linda George began wondering how the town's hundreds of miles of trails got their names and who built them in the first place. Rather than let the questions go unanswered, she jumped into the research.
I've been exploring and enjoying Park City Trail since the late 80s, and over time I've gotten really curious about the names of a lot of the trails. And so I went and talked to Laura Anthony about an idea about writing a trail guide with some history, and she was excited. And she also reached out to Ross about possibly doing a film. So that was basically the start of it. We've been doing a lot of research and work on this.
Russ Downard, a filmmaker and photographer who has lived in Park City for 2 decades, has extensively documented the area and its athletes. Now he and George are working together to capture the stories of those who helped shape Park City's trail culture. They've already shot about a dozen interviews for the film. George has also recorded audio interviews to support the guidebook's narrative. Downard has reels of archival footage, including material he's shot for Deer Valley and the Park City Chamber Bureau. He's now looking for older video and photographs from the earliest days of mountain biking in the 1980s and 90s.
There's lots of stuff around the Norba races. That is a big part of our history. Park City Television has a great archive stuff, but that really came in the early 2000s, you know. So trying to find this stuff, like Joan Thompson, local, she had great photos of her daughters, Whitney and Carrie, riding in foam helmets, rigid bikes.
In the 1980s, Park City had a shop that sold mountain bikes, but few places to ride them. That's when local riders started building pirate trails across private land.
They don't want to be considered as pirates, essentially. But it's part of our culture. It's how our trail system started. And it's still kind of pushes things today.
Downard plans to complete the 39-minute film by the end of the year to meet his grant requirements. The film is expected to premiere in Park City as a fundraiser for the Mountain Trails Foundation. George is finishing interviews while writing the guidebook. She says proceeds from the book will also support local trail initiatives. They're asking anyone with old biking photos, video, or memorabilia from Park City's early mountain biking days to contribute. Materials can be shared by emailing parkcitytrailhistory@gmail.com. In the studio now with a recap from yesterday's Summit County Council meeting, I have Councilmember Roger Armstrong. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start with the resort community sales tax discussion. County staff announced that they'll be asking council to adopt a new sales tax next week. It's called the Impacted Communities Sales Tax, but it sounds like it's for counties with major tourism activity. How much is the sales tax supposed to go up?
We could take it up to, I think, 1.1%. I don't know that we're going to take it that high. We really do have to take a look. We've got a number of different tools that the legislature gave us last year that are important. We've looked at, Park City has had this kind of resort community sales tax for a long time. And, you know, when we have 25,000 or 100,000 tourists that are coming in during Sundance or, you know, during the ski season, the impacts are not limited to Park City. We have impacts on our roads in Summit County. We have impacts on our law enforcement and our emergency services. The hospital has all kinds of impacts. So we've always had in the back of our minds, this is only available to cities with resorts within their municipal boundaries. Counties haven't had access, and the legislature corrected that. So it does give us an opportunity to have some additional funds to take care of transportation and transit impacts specifically is what this is for. And with the Olympics coming up, this tax could generate as much as $17 million a year initially out of the box first year. And then obviously long term it could continue to do that and enable us to take care of some of those big projects like Kimball Junction, possibly helping with the BRT, just transit generally. It could be a big deal. We have to balance that with the impact on tourism. You know, if you raise our taxes, our sales taxes to 20%, not only would the residents be unhappy about it, but I think tourists would find another place to go. We're not doing that. That's an example, the extreme example, but I think what I've asked to see next week is how we stack up to other resort communities and what our sales tax looks like compared against them.
Yeah, I'm curious, what is the law define, though, this as those areas that could use this new sales tax initiative?
It's transportation, infrastructure, and transit.
So anybody in the county or anybody in the state could do this?
If they're in, again, you've got to be in a jurisdiction. It's called the Impacted Communities Taxes Act. So you've got to be in a jurisdiction that's got some sort of tourism kind of generation that creates these kinds of disparate impacts. You know, some places don't have those kinds of impacts that just kind of come and go. And that's why this allows sales taxes generally fall heavier on tourists. In terms of actually funding what we have, tourists are funding some of the impacts that they have on the community if we use the sales tax rather than property taxes and other sources.
Yeah, what is that breakdown? Do we know in terms of tourists how much of the sales tax that they're paying versus the locals?
I think it's well over 60%, as I recall, but that's pulling it from the dark corners of my brain.
Yeah. There are exemptions to the, and that would be, you couldn't add it to the gas pump.
Great. Yeah. Unprepared foods, if you go to, you know, the grocery store and you buy food to prepare at home, that's not taxed. Prescription drugs aren't taxed. Gas is not taxed. So it doesn't have on the absolute necessaries. It's not doing that.
Yeah. What would that, we don't know what the final number is. What are you thinking it might be? I mean, if you can go up to 1.1.
I don't know the answer, but I suspect it's going to be something close to half that, I would think. But I don't know. I've not talked to my other colleagues about it.
Okay. So staff will also be asking the council to authorize a bond for what and how much?
Well, again, when you've got these revenue sources and revenue coming in, we always look to see, is there an opportunity to issue a bond that would be funded by those revenues? And over a 20-year period, that bond could generate quite a bit of money. But when you look at the transit and transportation projects that are contemplated between now and the Olympics, they start to come pretty close to $100 million. So a bond could help generate that source of revenue to pay for those. So you're essentially getting those monies in advance and repaying it as you go.
Yeah, so that's a general obligation bond, right?
Correct.
You have the taxes to basically pay back. But we don't know how much the bond could be until we know what the
rate's
going to be.
Right. Yep.
All right. Is this going to be used to pay for any of the Dakota Pacific improvements that need to be made?
I would look at it at the big parking structure that we've looked at. You know, I think Park City and Summit County have both talked about the need for capture parking. Where can we, if we really want people to leave their cars and take transit or gondolas or whatever, I guess gondolas would be characterized as transit, but if we were asking them to get out of their cars, not drive in, take some sort of transportation into the cores, how do we do that? Where do they leave those cars? And right now, there are not a lot of great choices. We've got, the Ecker Hill Park and Ride, which has been, I think, for the Pine Brook and Jeremy Ranch parts of the county, has been useful. I think there we do have some ski traffic that does that. I'd like to see the resorts kind of push that a little bit more and encourage people to use it. But Kemble Junction and I think we've talked about 1,100 spaces or something there. I'm not sure that that's the final number, but to get that number of spaces in a place where we can capture the number of cars that we could take off the road there, that would be worthwhile. And we're paying for that, or at least paying for a portion of it, so we need funds to do that.
All right. Any other specific projects staff has in mind that would fall under this transportation infrastructure and transit?
Yeah, I don't know how it fits in with BRT, what that relationship is, because High Valley is separate from us, but we do have transit and transportation taxes already through that. Remember the quarters that they did a few years ago, and we passed that those quarters. So we do get revenue from that we've dedicated to High Valley Transit for them to expand their transit offerings, and that's been remarkably successful. So I assume some of this will go to close the gap on BRT, which is a significant cost.
Yeah. County staff presented some spending trends to the council yesterday, showing that U.S. consumer spending slowed down in September. The staff also presented data showing hotel occupancy down compared with the historic norm. So how does that inform your decision on imposing additional sales tax?
Well, it does. I mean, I think we have to, it informs two things. Number one is the overall budget. Are we being conservative in the budget that we're passing this year? Now, part of this budget, we've got, a $10 million increase in the budget. It's going up to pretty close to $100 million this year is the manager's proposed budget. Where it winds up, we'll see. So we have to, what I asked the manager yesterday is, please go back and take a really hard look at this, because somehow with the tariffs and other things that have gone on, there's been a lot of predictions that was going to lead to some pretty harsh economic consequences. We haven't seen that yet. We are seeing some of those results that you were talking about in terms of consumers appearing to start to become more concerned. I just heard on the radio coming in that interest rates are starting to affect the amount of money people have to spend and the cost of things. We have to be mindful and forward-thinking as we approach this budget and make sure that we're not overextending ourselves and over-relying on some of these sales tax revenues that could shrink a bit. I don't know that the bottom's going to absolutely fall out. If you go back to 2008, 2009, we did pretty good. If you look at the pandemic, we survived pretty well. We had to make some cuts, but we survived.
Oh, and you had a lot of federal dollars coming in, too.
We did. That's true.
So this $10 million budget increase, are we talking is because of the bonding for the 910, the year ranch? I mean,
A chunk of that are these kinds of revenues. I mean, if we anticipate having some of these additional sales taxes, under Utah law, we have to have a balanced budget. So we can't pull in more revenue than we're prepared to spend. So if you've got new revenue coming in, you book it on one side and you've got to allocate it to something else. So that's just new revenue.
Okay. New revenue as opposed to increased.
Well, I suspect we're going to have some asks from county staff to, just in terms of doing their everyday jobs. We suffer just like consumers suffer. County government suffers from inflation, and we have to deal with that as well.
All right. My understanding is that new taxes only kick in halfway through the fiscal year. So why is that? So you wouldn't get these monies until next July?
Yeah, you approve the increase. I think there's a 90-day waiting period. It goes into effect, and then you start the collections at that point, and the collections don't get paid out for some period of time after that. So, yeah, there is a delay.
All right. Any talk about increasing property taxes, which are a little bit more reliant, right?
Yeah, they are more reliant, but they have different kinds of impacts, harder impacts, I think, especially in a market where things are escalating as rapidly as some of our housing prices and property values have increased. The answer is no, there's not going to be a property tax increase by the county. I think, you know, school districts are looking at doing things, fire districts are looking at making adjustments. Snyderville Basin Rec is making an adjustment, but the county is not going to go through Truth in Taxation this year. These sales taxes are helping us hold the line against that. And you know, I've been on council finishing 13 years right now, and I think we've increased assessing and collecting once. We increased general municipal, I think, in 2018, the only time we've done that since I've been on council. So that's something that is, I think, most of us feel is a last-ditch effort. The legislature wants us to look at sales taxes about every 5 years and consider whether or not to go through Truth in Taxation, but thus far we haven't had to do it.
Okay, and so back to the budget for next year. You asked staff to look for areas to trim, anywhere staff can grit their teeth until things are more stable. So what are you envisioning here?
Just what I said, you know, with the uncertainty in the economy, not knowing exactly where we're likely to go, if things really do start to slow, I want to make sure that the services that we have to provide, our mission is health, safety, and welfare. So as long as we're covering those, as long as our roads are maintained and we don't have to look at massive road projects to fix things down the line, that's important. Our sheriff's deputies, our EMS, make sure those are all healthy. And then anything above that, the nice-to-haves are should be at the end of the line.
All right. You also acknowledge what happens when departments go underfunded. And I guess one of those examples would be when we deferred road maintenance, and then that what becomes more expensive in the long run?
Yeah, you can do seals, you can do a number of things to keep roads maintained longer, because once they do wear down and you get that destruction of the top of the road, you've got to grind it all the way down and rebuild the road, and that's extraordinarily expensive.
Yeah, so are there other situations where we kind of saw that happen over the last 13
years?
Yeah,
no, I think, you know, the assessor's office, I remember we had some pretty hard conversations 2 or 3 years ago, and the assessor asked for additional staff for her department, and we deferred that, and it resulted in some real problems in terms of the assessor being able to do assessments across the board. Citizens felt it. They were really upset about it, and we corrected it when, you know, it became really apparent what was happening. So it's to avoid those kinds of situations so that, again, in terms of the basic functions and services that we provide, that we can continue to do so in an effective way.
All right. The council approved a 3-year contract extension for County Manager Shane Scott. Any changes to the prior terms?
No, I think we have some minor tweaks to it, but no.
More money?
His raises come from the same raises that the rest of staff gets.
All right. And what was the council's assessment of his performance?
Shane's doing a good job. I think, you know, he stepped into a complicated situation. He's got a solid deputy county manager, and I think, you know, that's a pretty good lift. He's integrated himself well into the community. I think he was drinking from a fire hose for the first year, I'm sure, just trying to get his bearings, but I think he's doing a good job.
All right. The council tabled a road vacation on Lewis Peak near Colville. That doesn't mean a right-of-way holiday. It means that formerly public roads are becoming private, but council didn't vote. Why not?
A new law was passed by the legislature, another one of those where they, when you least expect it, they spring up. It took effect in May, and it says that we have to inform UDOT, and we also have to have a public hearing, and I think give 6 months' notice. There was some timing issue, so we were not able to take action yesterday. We could have had a public hearing, but we've got to wait 6 months before we can take this up again. And because of that, we just told the folks, thank you for coming in.
Okay.
See you in 6 months.
Council also passed a proclamation supporting the state's A Bolder Way Forward initiative for women and girls. The initiative's goal is to make measurable progress toward gender equity by 2030. Were you there for the Rotary Club's speech by the initiative's founder?
I was not.
No? Okay. It does sound like the speaker there at Rotary shared some alarming but not surprising statistics on gender disparities.
Yeah, I think, I don't want to go into, you know, what are all of my speculations about that, but I do think that anything that we can do to help further shortfalls as it relates to gender, girls, making sure that they're safe, making sure that they're protected, that they have opportunities in a place where there seems to be some data that shows that they might be falling behind educationally, professionally, and again, just in terms of security.
So what does this proclamation do?
It calls on us to help promote those kinds of activities. When initiatives come up through this program, for us to support them and promote them. There's nothing really specific about it, and you know, obviously if that support involves financial support, that's something that would have to come back to the council for discussion. But you know, a proclamation is a good place to start.
Okay, and council have a closing date for the 9:10 yet?
Not yet. every time we think we're there, we're right at the finish line, something happens. Right now it's the shutdown. And
The money is in escrow.
It's here at the state. We've got that money in place, but there are a couple of other things that we've got to finalize, and I think the shutdown is affecting that.
Yeah. Do we have any legal complications?
I don't think so. No. It's steps.
Okay. Your ranch, however, is different because of the shutdown.
It is. There's some funding there that's likely not available anymore. We'll be able to cover it, but... every time we turn around, there's something that just makes things wobble a bit. So we'll get there. I think your is imminent.
All right. By the end of the year?
Maybe.
Okay. Anything else, Roger?
That's it.
All right. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Leslie.
Summit County Council Member Roger Armstrong. In the studio now with a final update of this year's summer season is the Executive Director of Summit Community Gardens and Eats, Helen Nadel. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So what kind of year did we have in the garden?
It was a great year. I mean, I have to say it's a little bittersweet every winter to say goodbye to the season, but it was really terrific. Just recapping a few things. Camp this season was amazing. We were able to provide scholarships for about 22% of campers. So pretty significant in terms of just making sure that anybody who wants to come to a magical garden camp can do that. We welcomed people through LaMilpa. We did a lot with wellness in the garden this season as well. We had free yoga for families, free yoga sponsored through both Randy Joe's yoga and also PC Yoga Collective, as well as free meditation every week with Summit County Mindfulness. So those opportunities to bring people to the garden are really cool. We had 50% of the people who came to our dinners in the garden were brand new visitors to the garden. So that was really fun to just, there's so many different ways that people can get involved. We had 350 volunteers, which was a big increase even from last year. And of course, food pharmacy, which I know we'll talk about in a second. I think that, one of the things that I've heard people mention to me is, I didn't know I could come to the community garden. And I think so many people feel like a community garden is, they're used to a community garden where there's sort of a lock on it and you can only go there if you have a plot. And nothing could be further from the truth with our community garden, which is truly a place for the entire community to gather and come. We've, the snacking garden this year created a really cool opportunity for people to just, we had families walking over from Matinute Park after practice, lots of people just coming in and getting to come to a special section of the garden where you could just walk in and taste whatever you wanted. We're going to expand that next year, so there'll be even more opportunities to come and taste and have that direct connection to local agriculture and food. And we also have flowers, so you can come and pick a few flowers. So that's, you know, there's so many ways to get involved, and I just really want people to know the garden only closes when that gate closes for snow. Otherwise, you are welcome to come in, whether you're a plot runner or there to pick up your kid for camp or just want to sit down and have a lovely picnic or a walk through the garden.
Okay. So all of the after-school program camps have
finished. We are complete for the season. Yep. Yeah, yeah. We are up in the schools. You know, we are, a lot of people also ask me, well, what do you do? What do you do in the winter? And there's so much that we do in the winter up in the schools. So that's really the focus of our work right now. We see about 400 kids a month up in the schools doing, you know, cooking, nutrition education, really connecting kids to how food grows. Like there's some just agricultural tidbits that are really fun for kids to learn about. And they, you know, I mean, we were, you know, last week I was in with some kindergartners with our education coordinator, Gabriella, and we were talking to kiddos, you know, who are like pretty little, right? They're just out of preschool about, the different food groups and what different food groups do and how important it is to eat different foods and sorting. You know, we had actual foods they were sorting and then got to eat. Lots of hands-on activities there. So lots of fun.
So are those after-school programs or you go into the schools during, you know, and it's curriculum-based?
That's a great question. And there's some of both that happens. So every single Friday we are in the after-school programs throughout the Park City schools. We're also on Mondays and Fridays, we're in the YSA in middle schools, sort of starting in November and running through March or April. And then we also are in the preschools during the school day, enrichment during the school day. So it's really a mix of after school and in school part of the school curriculum.
Yeah. So is that all staff doing this or do you need volunteers to help?
Yeah, we do. So we do. I mean, staff leads all the programs, but we have volunteers always coming in. And I'll just give a shout out. We do need some volunteers for our Curious Cooks program that happens on Friday afternoons. So the after school, you know, school ends early on Friday, so that generally is sort of like a 1:30 to 3 o'clock time frame. We also need people to drive and help us deliver fresh fruit to our schools every week. We deliver 7 boxes of fruit to every school in Park City plus Holy Cross Ministries. And that's really a way for kiddos who wouldn't otherwise have access to a healthy snack to get one. We know from the school outreach coordinators, you know, these are kids who are primarily free and reduced lunch eligible. Families may be struggling. And we have volunteer drivers who drop that fruit off. And it's a really, we know it's an important, it's a small but really important for a group of families and children in our community. So yeah, Mondays and Fridays, big volunteer days. You can go to the website and there is a volunteer with us tab in the get involved tab. So that would be, we'd love to have some more volunteers.
Okay. As you mentioned, Summit Community Gardens is a partner in the food pharmacy program. So how did that go this year?
You know what? It was pretty amazing. We distributed, so Summit Community Gardens Eats donated a total of about 2,100 pounds of food to People's Health Clinic patients. That food, we delivered that food in two ways. One was that our partner, the Christian Center, helped to bag and deliver food to some of the most vulnerable folks in our community who are both food insecure, have some difficulty with travel, and also are experiencing things like hypertension, high blood pressure, of course, diabetes, prediabetes. And the idea that food is medicine is very, very important. These are, you know, doctors, medical professionals who've said, we need you to eat more fruits and vegetables. Summit Community Gardens Eats provides that. Christian Center delivers that every other week. And then, you know, on the other weeks during the summer, we were able to do a pop-up free farmers market at the People's Health Clinic. We had folks from the health department, folks from People's Health Clinic coming and grabbing a bag of fresh food. Our Spanish-speaking staff was talking to folks, you know, obviously in both English and Spanish, and really helping to encourage them to, you know, figure out what to do with it. So that was great, too. So 2,100 pounds in total.
I was just going to say, does that end, though? I mean, now that you're not growing food?
That is a great question, and it's actually an important change and gap that Summit Community Gardens is really hoping our community can help to fill. Traditionally, in years past, the Christian Center has been able to provide funds in the off-season, so in our off-season, when we're not growing food, we're able to, the Christian Center is able to purchase food and then, deliver it to folks, again, every other week. This year, due to some funding cuts and other changes, that's no longer possible for them. And so what Summit Community Gardens and Eats has done is to step up and say that we are going to continue that program. I do want to say this partnership is really powerful. It's three nonprofits coming together. The Christian Center continues to provide volunteers. The People's Health Clinic, obviously, the patients are there. They do all the patient interface. But we are really faced now with having to provide food, whether we grow it or whether we purchase it, for some of our most vulnerable community members. So would love for folks in the community to be aware of that. That's a big lift for a small nonprofit.
Yeah, I mean, what are we talking about? I mean, food's expensive.
Food is expensive. It's
especially
gotten more expensive.
Fruit and vegetables.
Yeah. And it's interesting, fruits and vegetables, again, like that idea of food is medicine. We know people are eating the food. Everyone who the People's Health Clinic survey says people are eating this food. They love it. But it's exactly the kind of food that's really hard for people to prioritize if they don't have a lot of money, because it's a lot cheaper to feed your family with a bag of rice or a bag of beans versus, spending money on vegetables. So we expect that it's going to be about $1,000 a month to provide food for it's between 32 and 35 patients and their families every other week. That's a lift for us.
So we're talking 6-8 months?
It's going to probably be about 8 months is what we expect. And we're doing some cool crop planning, this year to really think through how to grow more, even more shelf-stable food to enable us to deliver food and provide food longer and longer into the year. So, this year our distributions went all the way. We're harvesting all the way up until mid-October. Which was amazing. We are hoping to, if we can grow more things like potatoes, onions, carrots, root vegetables that are shelf stable, we can go longer. But in the meantime, we've got about 8 months to fill. And I'll just say, there is such strong commitment among all of the partners to keep this program going. We know what the impact is. And so it's something that happens. Especially right now with some of the changes in funding. So.
Okay. Finally, I want to just, how can folks be part of the community garden next season?
Yeah. Before we leave, I wanted to just mention one other thing about the food pharmacy this year. Just give a huge shout out to Copper Moose Farm. A full 424 pounds of food were either gleaned from fields, so food that at the very end of the season that they weren't going to be able to use, or they they provided it, anything that was left over from their store. So really, that's a significant amount of food. So I just want to give a shout out to Copper Moose Farm for that contribution to the food pharmacy. In terms of how folks can get involved in the garden, first of all, we have plots available starting in December to any new plot renter who would like to come. And I'll just throw out there, I feel like one of the things that was really exciting about this season is an amazing staff, Jess and Luce, who were so committed and excited to helping people learn how to grow food. The advice, the community building, it's a really, really fun place. If you're not sure you're going to be there all season, or you feel like you're a newbie and, are feeling a little, not confident, unsure about the amount of work, we have so many people who partner together. So two people will rent a plot, and that really, helps to provide that opportunity. Another way you can get involved in the garden, of course, is volunteering. But we really just encourage people to walk in the gate. It is available to everybody. Go to that snacking garden, pick some food, pick some flowers. We'd love to have you come and really enjoy it.
All right. So you offer the plots to existing renters before you open it up to
Correct.
The general public?
Correct. And we're looking for your renewal, Leslie. So we're going to be, we always provide the opportunity for anybody who's been gardening with us to renew their plots. And that process is happening now. We've already had lots of people rejoin. And we'll do that really, ideally through November through December, people will still be renewing. And then we do open up a list for new folks to get involved. And you can go to, on our website, there's a grow category and you can go right to garden with us. And first sentence there talks about hopping on that list.
Okay. We'll see you next season.
Thank you so much, Leslie, for the opportunity.
Helen Adel, again, the Executive Director of Summit Community Gardens and EAT. Well, North Summit School District is asking locals to vote for a $121 million bond this November. KPCW's Christine Weller reports the bond will fund the construction of a new high school and swimming pool.
The North Summit School District Board of Education, Superintendent, and Business Administrator are urging residents to vote yes on a general obligation bond on November 4th. They say the bond is needed to replace the aging North Summit High School and its swimming pool. The $121 million bond would be paid over 20 years through property taxes. The average homeowner in the district with a $722,000 property would pay $887 over that time period. A business of the same value would pay $1,600. That's about $40 per year for a homeowner and about $80 per year for a business. According to a voter pamphlet, the high school opened in the fall of 1977 and has many failing systems. In a letter to parents, the board, Superintendent Wade Murdoch, and Business Administrator Marcy Sargent said the high school's infrastructure is, quote, increasingly inadequate for safety and security. A new high school would feature modern safety standards, including secure entry points, emergency response systems, and accessibility features. District leadership said the new high school would be more sustainable and reduce long-term operational costs and environmental impact. It would also accommodate growth in the district. The pool is also outdated. While it's been well-maintained since its construction in 1966, it's outlived the lifespan of an aluminum pool. It's also not regulation size for high school standards. District leadership says a new high school and pool are a practical solution and necessary to ensure students continue getting a quality education. This is not the first time a bond for a new high school has been put before voters. In 2024, 56% of voters rejected a similar bond. The district said previously its only options are to approve the bond through the election process this year or fund the project through lease revenue bonds. To do that, the school board would create a local building authority to issue the bonds. LRBs don't require voter approval and are essentially the district going into debt. The district then pays the building authority back with money from property taxes as well. It's the same tool the Wasatch County School District used to fund its new high school in 2022 after its bond failed in 2019. If voters approve North Summit's bond, construction on a new high school will start in the spring of 2026. It would be built on district-owned property southwest of the Colville Cemetery. The new high school could serve 640 students with opportunities for expansion to meet future needs. The property also has room for athletics facilities, including a gym, auditorium, football stadium with an 8-lane track, practice field, baseball and softball diamonds, and outdoor courts. Once the new high school is completed, the old one will be torn down and the new pool will be built in its place. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Park City's newest housing development is opening next month after 2 years of construction at Quinn's Junction. KPCW's Connor Thomas has details on the apartments and businesses coming to Studio Crossing.
Crandall Capital is putting the finishing touches on two buildings with a mix of housing and retail at Quinn's Junction. They'll be the first to open as part of the Studio Crossing development. Developer Gary Crandall says his team is having discussions with possible restaurateurs and small boutique markets.
It's not big enough to have a Trader Joe's or somebody like that. And then we're talking about some dental people or kind of like a wine tasting bar area type thing, nail salons, so a whole variety of things.
There will be 60,000 square feet of commercial space when complete. Half the affordable housing will be ready next month, and a ribbon cutting is scheduled for November 7th. Eventually, there will be 208 apartments for area workforce, 50 three- and four-bedroom townhomes, and about 50 two- to three-bedroom condos. The condos and townhomes would sell at full price. Crandall says the market rate for the townhomes is around $1.5 million. The affordable apartments are aimed at people making 60% to 80% of the area median income in Summit County. But Crandall says Park City officials are allowing residents to remain in their unit even if they start making more money.
Usually when you're talking about affordable housing, somebody like if they're in the 60 or 70% category, once they hit that level, then they have to move out. And it really disincentivizes people to try to get ahead to maybe get a second job or work extra time or whatever.
Residents won't lose their apartment until they've hit 120% of area median income. The interest list, according to Crandall, is over 200 people long. Construction will still be in progress as residents begin to move in. Crandall plans to break ground on the rest of the affordable apartments in the spring. Crews are currently laying the foundations for the market rate townhomes. After that, they'll build the condominiums. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
In Park City, weekends mean golf, skiing, biking, and pretending you're still 25. We can't stop time, but we can help your body keep up. Acupuncture for pain, nutrition for performance, and integrative medicine for the rest. Our team keeps you on the mountain and out of the ice bath. Autumn Bear Wellness Collective, feel good longer. Autumn Bear Wellness Collective is a proud supporter of KPCW.
I'm Evan Jennings, owner of Pacific Siding. We want to thank you for 10 years of business in Park City. Whether you're updating your home or starting new, we offer complete exterior packages from siding, stone, metal, and more. We know the trends that add value and protection to your mountain home. Located in Quinns Junction, Pacific Siding, PACSiding.com, a local supporter of KPCW.
KPCW News Time now, 8:52. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, coming up on October 28th, Live Like Sam, along with Summit County Mental Health Alliance and Mothers Against Media Addiction, are offering a moderated panel on about how to create resilient kids. In the studio with details, I have the executive director of Live Like Sam, Ron Jackenthal. On the phone, I have the founder of We Be Will and one of the panelists, Alex Beecraft. Good morning to both of you. Thanks for joining us. Ron.
Good morning.
Let's start by having you kind of share the story behind Live Like Sam, and then we'll have Alex do the same.
Sounds great. Good morning, Leslie. Yeah, so Live Like Sam, as many in the community know, is a foundation we started in honor of my son Sam, who passed away 10 years ago. Excuse me. And, you know, Sam was this like bright light, an incredibly happy, positive kid. And over our family's grief journey, we really started to look into how do we continue Sam's legacy and make an impact in the community. And what we realized is our community is in a full mental health crisis across the country and especially here locally. And so we've built an organization, especially over the last 5 years, that provides well-being and prevention programming based in positivity to over 4,000 kids a year in the local public, private, and charter schools. And so a lot of what we are trying to do is get to the kids as early as possible, because if we can help them with life skills, you know, in elementary school, it will just help them go through middle and high school and launch into happy and healthy adults.
All right. And Alex, what is We Be Well and why did you found that?
Yeah. Thank you, first of all, for having us. Appreciate that. And so, yeah, we founded We Be Well. It's been 6 years now. And like Ron just shared, you know, there's an uptick in mental health issues with adolescents and college students in the United States that's kind of grown significantly. So we founded We Be Well to address that with both adolescents and college students and empower them to have a set of skills that can help them thrive, have better well-being, and ultimately flourish. So our program delivers evidence-based skills from the field of positive psychology, which is about our strengths and what makes us thrive and be at our best, and also clinical psychology, more geared towards the reduction of mental health issues such as depression, anxiety, and stress, and things of that nature. And so we deliver our program in a twofold manner. We have an amazing curriculum developed by some eminent psychologists in the well-being space and members of the We Be Well team. And so students can access our program on app and web platforms, but it's never tech alone. It's always with a support group component, mostly on Zoom, some in-person programs too, where students will get together in small groups and discuss what they're learning and applying in their lives and what's working for them. And so that's kind of our program in a nutshell.
Okay, you're doing so much for kids. Ron, you decided that we need to like have some parent training as well, and is that what next week's all about?
Yeah, right. So it's really about, I think, whole family system. You know, we are working with the kids, but if the parents don't know, you know, what we're doing, and if we're not addressing helping kids be happy and healthy and well-adjusted on all fronts, then I think we're missing out. So, you know, Live Like Sam's really committed to providing family programming. We start with kids. We're starting to bring the adults in, provide education tracks, bring in speakers, bring in films. We recently worked with the Mental Wellness Alliance, with MAMA Summit Support, to bring in a film, a documentary, Can't Look Away, last month. It was really powerful. We had over 300 people attend the movie. It's really about trying to get reforms on social media You know, at a national level, what we're seeing is really treacherous as far as like kids' mental health. It's probably one of the leading causes of upticks in depression and anxiety and isolation right now is social media. So, you know, a lot of what we've been, you know, and you can see my hat, like our campaign this year is resilience. And it's really, you know, resilience is a skill that can be taught. It's actually something that you don't have to be born with. You can teach resilience skills, you can practice, and you can learn how to be resilient. And the reality is, you know, you don't have to have something like losing a kid to need to be resilient. Life comes at you, and it's not a matter of if it's coming at you, it's when it's coming at you, and how often, and at what degree of intensity. So for us, if we can teach kids to cope with resilience, to be resilient early in life, it will help them carry through their life.
Sure. So give us the details. I mentioned it was October 28th. It'll be at Jim Sanning Auditorium. What's the time?
Yeah, so doors will open at 5:30. We'll have a number of members from the community tabling from 5:30 to 6. And then the presentation's really, the panel is from 6 to 7 to 7:15 or so.
All right. And as I mentioned, I think, Alex, you're going to be part of that panel. I guess maybe you can talk just briefly about what are some of the key challenges today's parents are facing that that this program will help address.
Yeah, I think as Ron shared, you know, there's been a significant uptick in mental health issues, and it's very complex and multifaceted, but social media is definitely something that a lot of researchers are pointing to that can really have negative impacts on adolescents' mental health. So, and it's, I mean, social media and technology are such a big part of our lives. And so I think, you know, parents face the challenge of that. Also, even after the pandemic, there was such social isolation from, you know, 2020 and a couple years thereafter. So, yeah, adolescents are more stressed than they have been before. So I think, you know, parents, like with this talk, will learn about some skills. You know, in the Thrive program, which we launched with Live Like Sam, we teach a lot of those skills, you know, that can help adolescents be resilient. I know there will be other panelists there. I believe some child psychiatrists will have a lot of great information on what to look for, right, when someone's child might be a little bit stressed out, how to support them so that they can be resilient in the face of stress and adverse events. So we'll talk a lot about what to look for, skills that can help individuals build resilience, the mindset that's important in being able to be resilient in challenging situations. So I think it'll be really informative on those fronts.
Well, yeah, speaking kind of within the context of parenting here, Ron, I mean, how do you define resilience? I mean, sometimes as a parent, it just feels like all you're ever doing is saying no.
You know, there's a lot of definitions, and I'd say, first of all, if you want to hear it from the professionals, come next Tuesday. But I mean, to me, you know, at its simplest form, it's the ability to cope when something goes wrong, right? It's the ability to have the tools on board to bounce back and, you know, really to look for positivity in every situation. And again, there's so much research on resilience that it can be learned. That we're very encouraged about this topic and this program. You know, our panelists will include Jed Thomas from the Park City School District, Dr. Eric Alta from Intermountain Healthcare, Alex, of course, Dr. Kristen Pagel from Huntsman Mental Health, Dr. Richard Martini from People's Health Clinic, and a Park City High School student, Luca Elliott.
Okay. I'm basically out of time, but I appreciate your time. Again, this is happening next Tuesday, the 28th. Doors open at 5:30 at the Jim Sanning Auditorium. The panel itself taking place at about 6.
You bet.
Okay. Sam, Alex?
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for your time.